From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Bill Cosby about television and comedy. Also, we look at the darkest period in Chile's history with writers Pamela Constable and Arturo Valenzuela. Their new book, A Nation of Enemies, examines how a country like Chile, with such a long tradition of democracy, fell to dictator Augusto Pinochet. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of music by two Czech composers who wrote their compositions while imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Palestine Liberation Organization leader Yasser Arafat said on French television tonight that he's willing to join Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir for a face-to-face meeting. Arafat stopped briefly in Paris today for a meeting with the Soviet and French foreign ministers. From Paris, here's reporter Lynn Terry.
Yasser Arafat spent more than an hour and a half with Soviet Foreign Minister Boris Pankin, who's here to sign a peace treaty on Cambodia. Following their meeting, a Soviet official read out a communique, which said the two men agreed that it was important not to miss the opportunity offered by the Middle East Peace Conference. The communique also said that a just solution to the Palestinian problem is at the heart of the conflict in the Middle East. Earlier, Arafat also met with the French foreign minister, and after that meeting, he said he had asked France to support the PLO, either directly or indirectly during the conference. Then on French TV, Arafat said he's willing to meet Yitzhak Shamir. He said Israel should have a leader like South African President F.W. de Klerk, who's been negotiating with Nelson Mandela. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said today that he doesn't expect any quick agreement to come out of next week's peace conference in Madrid. Shamir ruled out the possibility that Israel might relinquish any of the territory it acquired during the 1967 war, saying that Israel's security would be at risk. He said that attacks against Israel's heartland could be launched from the occupied territories if they were returned to neighboring Arab countries. Soviet Foreign Minister Boris Pankin said today that the peace conference should work on less emotional issues before it takes up the question of the occupied territories. Freed American hostage Jesse Turner was given a warm welcome today when he arrived at the U.S. military hospital in Wiesbaden, Germany. Janet Berry reports.
Staff and patients gathered on the balcony of the hospital to welcome Jesse Turner. He had flown 6 hours from Damascus to Rhein-Main Air Base, a short helicopter ride from Wiesbaden Military Hospital. Thorough medical checks will be carried out over the next few days, but Turner's general physical condition has been described as good. Turner waved and smiled at his well-wishers as he walked from the helicopter, but said nothing. Little is known about the conditions he was held under for 4.5 years. Turner is due to be reunited with his mother, wife, and 4-year-old daughter early tomorrow morning when they arrive in Germany. For National Public Radio, I'm Janet Barry in Wiesbaden.
Stock prices were down sharply today on Wall Street. Analysts attributed the drop to computerized program selling and a decline in the bond market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 21 points to close at 3,039.8. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 194 million shares. This is NPR News. The House has passed a complex anti-crime bill that expands the federal death penalty and puts new restrictions on prisoners who seek to appeal their convictions in the federal courts. The $1.1 billion measure also provides money to help states hire more police and increases security at schools in high-crime neighborhoods. The bill passed on a vote of 305 to 118 after 3 days of debate. It extends the federal death penalty to more than 50 crimes, but lawmakers eliminated a provision that would have banned several types of assault weapons. The man who headed U.S. operations for the Bank of Credit and Commerce International said today that Clark Clifford and Robert Altman had to know that the U.S. bank they ran was secretly owned by BCCI. Both Clifford and Altman insist they weren't aware of the allegedly illegal arrangement. Here's more from NPR's Neil Conan.
Abdur Sakia, at one time the senior BCCI official in the United States, said he served as chairman of a coordinating group that integrated marketing and business for BCCI's agencies in various U.S. cities with the U.S. banks it secretly controlled, including First American Bank. Testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Narcotics and Terrorism, Sakia said it was incredible that Clifford and Altman, then chairman and president of First American, did not know that the bank was owned by BCCI. Sakia said that BCCI funneled business and profits to First American, and that BCCI officials regarded First American as part of the BCCI group. He also testified that BCCI made payoffs to public officials in many of the countries in which it did business, but, so far as he knew, not in the United States. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
Survivors of Sunday's earthquake in the Himalayan foothill country of India are suffering from exposure and hunger. Officials say that the death toll is now at least 665, but some witnesses say it could go as high as 2,000. Survivors have been forced to sleep in the open without food. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. He's gone from stand-up comic to TV's most popular dad. My guest is Bill Cosby. In his stand-up act and on his sitcom, childhood has been his favorite subject. Now he has a new book of stories from his own childhood. Cosby grew up in a Philadelphia housing project. He had no show business contacts to help him get started. He didn't even get to see comics perform. He was too broke to ever buy a ticket and too afraid he'd get caught if he snuck in. The people he now thinks of as his comedy teachers are people he never met, people he knew only through records and books.
Two situations freed me up. The records that I bought and listened to later in the 60s, Jonathan Wetter's 2,000-year-old man, Lenny Bruce and Red Fox, and they all and Lord Buckley, they all had something in common, and that was that the joke did not come in the first 7 seconds, which is what everybody was saying. You have to be funny in the first 7 seconds, but none of these people did that. So it freed me up. It's sort of like a painter, and you really don't have all of your skills down pat, but you know that you want to paint and you have an idea of how you want to paint. But if you don't see anyone else doing it that is considered good or a master, then your particular idea is dependent upon how much strength you have in continuing your own want and your own philosophy. So hearing these five people gave me the incentive to stay on course with telling stories. I loved Mark Twain, and I think that was largely due to the fact that my brother Jimmy and I, after our mother bathed us, put us in the bed, and then she would read to us, and she would read Mark Twain. We didn't get the little rabbit that put the eggs out. We didn't get the little engine that could. I mean, we got Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, Connecticut Yankee. So I loved it. And then I listened to my grandfather. My grandfather, paternal grandfather, had the greatest way of telling stories. And I think, in fact, I am today part grandfather, paternal, and part my father, and physically my mother. And so I drew from these people.
Physically your mother?
Yeah.
How so?
Facial expressions and physical attitude.
So I'm curious what you got from Red Fox, and I ask that since he was so well known for his you know, blue humor, and your routine was always really clean.
Red's intonation, his ability, the different way that he told a story. See, Red is, the material may be blue, but Red, in essence, was a storyteller.
What was the stuff for you right before you started performing? You know, what was it that made you realize, well, I could probably do this?
I was always dabbling. And people would say, you know, you're funny. You ought to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. And my answer to them was, right, just walk right up. I think a part of what kept me from really taking it seriously was because you're looking at the 50s and the 60s, and you're looking at no Negroes wanted here. So there was nothing really that gave me a feeling that I could. And since I had not played the Uptown Theater and didn't, I mean, you have to be a tremendous star in order to go to New York and play the Apollo. The jazz clubs didn't have stand-up comics. There was really no place that had a sign saying that Negroes could come here and do stand-up comedy. I think the commitment came when I had all of my academic world set, my athletic world set, and then this show business world. I could toy around with that and not be super, super serious about entering the area. So first, while at Temple University, was to become the best junior high school physical education teacher these kids had ever seen, and to save all of them from themselves. Number two was to perhaps delay the teaching career and play pro football as a defensive back. And number three was to tell these jokes. So while at college, I played three sports, was on the dean's list, and then in the evenings to supplement my mother's and father's checks, I took a job as a bartender at a place called the Cellar Bar. It was Broad and Spruce, I think it was. And that's where, mixing drinks, I would tell the customers, we would trade jokes, really, and I'd get tips from that. It was a white Englishman and his white wife, who was English also, became regular customers. And then one day he said, I was telling a fellow at a club called the Gaslight in Greenwich Village about you, and he wants to give you a job as a comedian. And so I said, okay, thank you.
So that's where it started for you, in the Village?
Absolutely.
And that was a place where there wouldn't be obstacles created by your being black?
No. When I went in, the job description was fantastic. The guy said to me, I need somebody to break up the monotony of the folk singers. So that freed me up right away. I mean, so, you know, after these people sing about the wind called Mariah and the Dust Bowl and going fishing, et cetera, and the falsetto voices, and after they stood there tuning up. I could never understand why folk singers didn't tune up in the back and then come out front. They always came out and stood there for a good 10 minutes tuning up in front of the audience. So when the folk singer would come off, and my job actually was to introduce the next folk singer, I had 10 to 15 minutes, and I would do any number of routines.
So you did really well as a comic, and eventually ended up acting. I think your first real acting job was co-starring on the TV series I Spy, where you were an undercover agent playing with Robert Culp. This was the first dramatic series to star a black actor, I Spy. The first non-comedy series. You wanted to know about the script before you would sign on. What kinds of things did you want to know?
I wanted to know how they were going to treat the Negro. I certainly was not going to be a black joke. And I certainly was not going to be afraid of ghosts. But let me tell you, first of all, that the fellows, the writers, David Friedkin and Mort Fine, along with Shelton, I never had a problem with them at all. If anything, they made Alexander Scott a super, super, super hero. Guy was a Rhodes Scholar, spoke seven languages, et cetera, et cetera. So there was never a problem. I just wanted to see the script to make sure, because I had done a show prior to I Spy called That Was the Week That Was, and it was comedy, and I was the only Negro on the program. And some of the scripts that came through, I never did some of those routines because the jokes were always about my color. And I said to the writers, I'm not doing it. So finally, one of the writers came out. I said, well, why aren't you doing these jokes? I said, well, these jokes are all about, they're on me, and they're about my color, and you guys are not writing anything to counter. I don't counter this person's statement to me. And if it is funny, then why can't I say this about the white guy?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Cosby. He's written a new book called Childhood. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Bill Cosby is my guest. When you started The Cosby Show 8 years ago, did it feel like it was going to be momentous in any way to have a sitcom about a black upper-middle-class family? Did that feel like it was going to be groundbreaking? I'm not talking about the ratings, but just in terms of what television shows.
First and foremost was not the color. First and foremost for me was getting the control of the family back into the hands of the parents.
I mean, as opposed to the shows where the kids are always the wise guys and get the jokes and are smarter in the long run.
Yes, exactly. And I felt that this was leading to a horrible image for parents, and would be detrimental to children.
I read somewhere that someone in the network wanted the character of Cliff Huxtable to be a chauffeur.
No, nobody on the network. I said that.
Oh, you said that.
I said that. Nobody in the network said that. I said that. Well, And my wife said, that's not a job I want to see you with. But I don't think anybody really understood the reason for it. My reason for it. Some people felt, well, here you are, you know, being a servant again. And I said, no. To me, if a guy owned his own car, if he put his money in and bought a limousine, a Lincoln, and he polished it every day, man, and he had clients, and he was hustling, and he was on the go, this would show that this was a working man and an entrepreneur, at that.
Well, what changed your mind about the character being a chauffeur?
My wife said she felt that he would look like a servant no matter what. And then Marcy said, I don't think that the United States of America will accept you as a chauffeur. So I said, okay.
Do you think that the series is any more realistic than, say, Father Knows Best or Ozzie and Harriet? And here's the reason why I ask. You know, so much of the time, you know, the parents are on the couch or in the kitchen, either, you know, cracking wise with the kids or just being wise for the kids. And, I mean, although they have these really high-pressure jobs, they never seem to have to work or really bring that pressure home. They just have unlimited time for the kids.
Yeah. I don't remember Archie Bunker. He would come home. But I don't remember seeing Archie's job. Fred McMurray sat around. I mean, it's a prototype.
Mm-hmm. Your attitude is that's just the way sitcoms are.
I think that my attitude is that we were going to do a sitcom. The difference would be in the attitude that the parents had towards the kids compared to what I had been seeing over the past 5 years. Now, whether that got into this Father Knows Best or whatever, I don't know. I don't think people change that much. I think that even in coming up with ideas that happen to come from my experience in life or something I had just seen or something that happened in my home with one of my children, even that story, and I think a great deal of it has to do with writers. I have a problem with sitcom writers, some, because they are called writers, and they have this arrogance within and about themselves, and it's not healthy, and it isn't good, because if you're called a writer, then that means you're paid to sit down or stand and think, which, as far as I'm concerned, many of the writers that I had didn't do their job. They reached back, they grabbed old jokes, they tried to force old situations, and I constantly came with ideas that I thought they were fresh. And obviously, it was a problem for these people. The other problem is that most writers, most sitcom writers, are dedicated to the joke first. And you've got to really suspect somebody who can write a joke, have someone say it, and then the writer presses the button and laughter comes out of a machine and they say, that's funny.
Right.
You've got to suspect those people.
It has been written about in some publications that you have been estranged from your second oldest daughter. And I wonder if you feel that that's put you in a very awkward position as, you know, television's wisest dad to have a serious problem in your own family that has been made public.
No, not at all. I never said to anybody that I was America's father. Some writer decided that would be a good hook, and I don't think it was anybody out of my public relations firm, I'm pretty sure. However, just being a celebrity would cause something like that to go public because you are a celebrity. Your kid goes out and drinks too much one night, and it is Cosby Kid.
So, if you don't mind my asking, are you on a better relationship now with your daughter, or would you care to not discuss that? Or
we are on the same wavelength that we've always been on. Erin is our daughter. We love her very, very much. And she has her own way of living the life that she wants to live. And as she gets older, this way of living, whatever it is solely her choice. It's a matter of how she wants to live. But we have four other children, and would you like to hear about them?
Sure.
No, you don't either.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Cosby, and I should mention he's written a new book called Childhood. I know that a lot of people wonder why, when you've been so successful, do you still continue to do commercials on TV? So let me ask you that.
I ate Jell-O pudding when I was the smallest of, and I made it. I made Jell-O pudding. That was a dessert. Lower economic. I drank Coca-Cola when I was a kid. These things were really sort of like heroes. Driver Ford. Lower economic people look at, well, I did anyway. I looked at these things and I heard the commercials, and they were big. So when people came and said, you know, we'd like you to represent MB, I mean, that was just as important to me as doing I Spy.
So do you know when the last Cosby Show taping is going to be?
Somewhere around the end of March, I think, yes.
And are you looking forward to the end?
Yes, because that's the show we're going to do, the doorbell.
The doorbell?
There's something that I'm in love with this year, and that is a running gag. Cliff is trying to fix the doorbell, and the doorbell does not ring.
Oh, right. It rings funny.
Yes.
It rings like it's got a sore throat or something.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah. And different ways. Yeah. And different ways. And I love that. And I would love to tell you, you know, what's going to happen, but I think it would ruin it for you. But something's going to happen to the doorbell.
Right.
Lisa Bonet is just fine, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
My guest has been Bill Cosby. He's written a new book called Childhood. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During the reign of Augusto Pinochet in Chile, friend turned in friend and parent turned in child to appease the military dictatorship. What led them to do the unimaginable? And how could a country with a long tradition of democracy become hostage to such a brutal dictatorship? Coming up, we examine how, with Pamela Constable and Arturo Valenzuela, the authors of the new book, A Nation of Enemies. During World War II, Czech composers Gideon Klein and Viktor Ullmann were held in a concentration camp and later put to death at Auschwitz. But the music they composed there survives. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of their compositions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Israeli Prime Minister Shamir says that any effort to change his country's borders would be an invitation to war. The Israeli Prime Minister has told members of the European Parliament not to expect a fast agreement at an upcoming Middle Eastern peace conference, adding that the gulf between the two sides is still too wide. A conference sponsored by the United States and the Soviet Union opens next week in Spain, and Palestinians have announced their list of delegates to the meeting. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinian leader Faisal Husseini announced the list of 14 delegates at a packed news conference in East Jerusalem. Israel has always insisted it will not negotiate with members of the PLO, Palestinians from Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem, or Palestinians from outside the occupied territories. All of the names on the list meet Israeli criteria. But Husseini also announced a 7-member advisory council, which he will head. Israeli analysts said the members of the council do not meet the Israeli conditions and are clearly an attempt by the PLO to show it has a role in the peace conference. Husseini has repeatedly said he takes his orders from the PLO. Israeli Prime Minister Shamir played down the importance of the advisory council, saying the members will not be in the conference hall during the talks. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
In New York City, the UN said today that Afghan President Najibullah is prepared to give up power if it will help resolve that country's political stalemate. This could lead to an end of the nation's 12-year-long civil war. NPR's Jim Zaroli has more on the story.
In a major report released today, UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar said the Afghan situation had reached a critical stage. Perez de Cuellar said he had been assured that certain controversial personalities were prepared to relinquish their posts once questions about transitional rule were answered. Western officials said this was a clear reference to the Afghan president. The departure of Najibullah could clear the way for political talks between the various Afghan rebel groups who have been united in opposing him. This could bring about an end to the long Afghan civil war, but officials say sharp differences remain among the rebel groups, and Najibullah's resignation might bring those differences into sharper focus. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Jesse Turner, who spent nearly 5 years held hostage in Lebanon, is now at a U.S. military hospital in Germany. Turner's wife, mother, and daughter are on their way to Germany to see Turner, who has never seen his 5-year-old daughter. Turner told reporters in Damascus he was very happy to be out and was looking forward to seeing his family and friends. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 20 points to close at 3,039.80 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, by a vote of 305 to 118, the House has approved a sweeping anti-crime bill. Under the $1.1 billion measure, the death penalty would be imposed on more than 50 federal crimes. There would be more money for tighter security in drug-ridden areas, and prison inmates would be tested for drug use. Before the bill is sent to the White House, differences with the Senate version have to be worked out. The bill approved by the Senate bans certain types of semi-automatic assault weapons, which the House has turned down. On the eve of the signing of the Cambodian peace accord, a 5-month-old ceasefire has been shattered by intense fighting in northwestern Cambodia. Guerrilla forces charge that government troops are trying to retake guerrilla-controlled territory. Mary Kay Magstead has this report from the Thai-Cambodian border.
Dozens of dull thuds from mortar and artillery shells are still audible here, just on the Thai side of the Cambodian border. The spokesman of the U.S.-backed Khmer People's National Liberation Front, Oksarai Sopiak, claims the reason is that Cambodian government troops have started a major offensive to retake guerrilla-controlled territory. He said government troops have already seized control of the village Phum Prai, about 30 miles inside Cambodia, and appear determined to take the provincial capital, Thma Phuc.
I think logically they will try to do it. Yes. And I worry that many civilian lives will lost in the next few days.
There is not yet any confirmation from the Cambodian government about the cause of the renewed fighting. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstad on the Thai-Cambodian border.
Members of the European community have agreed on creation of a common market, including 19 nations. This plan will speed up trade between countries that already account for more than 40% of the world's commerce. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How does a democracy become a dictatorship, and what makes people cooperate with a brutal regime? The new book, A Nation of Enemies, uses Chile as a case study of how one dictator established a climate of fear. Chile had been one of Latin America's more stable democracies until Augusto Pinochet seized power in 1973. Last year, his rule was ended, and Chile returned to democracy. My guests are authors Pamela Constable and Arturo Valenzuela. Constable has been the Latin American correspondent for the Boston Globe since 1983. Valenzuela is a professor of government and director of the Center for Latin American Studies at Georgetown University.
Well, I think that what we set out to do was to try to explain something of a puzzle. Here's a country that for many, many years had been viewed as one of the beacons in Latin America, a country that had established democratic politics a long time ago, way back in the 19th century. And it was known for its civility and its good behavior and its congressional debates and so on and so forth, and yet was taken over by a brutal military government. And we wanted to understand what happened, why this happened, and then what happened to the society during the period of military rule. You know, how did the Chileans cope with the military rule? What happened to the justice system? What happened to the political parties? Why a society became, as the title of our book implies, a nation of enemies, because it wasn't a nation of enemies prior to that.
You think that the simple answer to the question is, how does a military dictator establish the climate for dictatorship in his country is fear. Does that about sum it up?
Partly, I would add to that word anger. There was tremendous anger in that society, tremendous division and hatred that had been generated within the society during the socialist period that preceded the military government, which enabled it to use that kind of emotions to establish the kind of culture of fear that you're describing.
From reading your book, I get the impression that the first place that Pinochet established a climate of fear was in the military itself. How did he do that?
That's exactly right. When the military took over, they weren't really prepared for what was going to happen, and certainly most of the people within the ranks of the military institution weren't really prepared for what was going to happen. And there was considerable trepidation on the part of the leaders about whether the coup was going to work. In fact, they weren't really confident that the society was going to fully support them, and they weren't even that confident, I think, that many of their own officers were going to support them. So when they moved very, very viciously against the constitutional government, what they tried to do was to instill within the institution itself a feeling of fear. The linchpin of this was the so-called Z plan, which was a classic counterintelligence or black warfare measure on the part of the military themselves. And they basically tried to convince their own officers that, in fact, they were targets themselves of some kind of assassination plot on the part of the left. And this engendered a feeling of fear. But you also have to remember that any professional military institution is trained to go to war. And even if the adversaries are not very, very strong, they will hit them with everything they have. And that's what we got from many of the officers who said, look, you know, we realize now that maybe we went too far, but you know, we were trained to kill. And in fact, when we were faced with that, we just had to give it all we had.
Well, Pinochet actually declared a state of internal war. What kind of power did that give him within the military?
There were a number of different states of emergency, as they were called. They primarily, for example, gave the military essentially authority to declare curfews, to censor all the media. There were hundreds, literally hundreds, of legal decrees, all of which dealt with various stages of suppressing civilian rights.
I'm wondering if you found, with your interviews with military people, if they did what they did under Pinochet out of fear or out of belief and loyalty.
I would say that it's particularly important to add the concept of anti-communism as a doctrine that was ingrained into the Chilean army in particular for the past 20, 30 years. Until the 70s, it was really an abstract concept for most of them, but it was very, very much indoctrinated into them. And then when they saw socialism actually coming to fruition in Chile and they disliked much of what they saw, they felt the society was being torn apart, losing control. This built up in them a kind of an obsession. In fact, the kind of words that Pinochet and his colleagues on the junta used repeatedly were these apocalyptic phrases: "We must uproot the scourge of communism from our country." These kinds of slogans were used repeatedly to galvanize both the civilian populace and, in particular, the armed forces into maintaining this high level of rage and of really almost hysterical obsession with wiping out not only the radical but also the moderate left and indeed any opposition to the government.
If you're just joining us, my guests are the authors of a new book called A Nation of Enemies, Chile Under Pinochet. Pamela Constable has been the Latin American correspondent for the Boston Globe since 1983. Arturo Valenzuela is a professor of government and director of the Center for Latin American Studies at Georgetown University. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Pamela Constable and Arturo Valenzuela, co-authors of the new book, A Nation of Enemies, Chile Under Pinochet. You write in the book, like all dictatorships, Pinochet made spies of the unscrupulous, sycophants out of the ambitious, and conformists of the majority. I'm wondering if you were able to interview anybody in Chile who spoke honestly about turning a friend or a neighbor or a colleague in to protect themselves or for any other reason. Are people at the point where they can talk about that to you?
In fact, this happened on numerous occasions, and I'll tell you why. They might not have told us about this if they had known what would happen to the people. But very often, people turned friends in or even children in. We interviewed a father and mother who turned in their daughter to the police. But they didn't think at the time that anything really serious would happen to them. There was kind of a basic trust and belief that there would be a due process of law, that if they had been involved in anything that was illegal, that they would be tried, and they would have to pay for the consequences. In a sense, they were reacting from the civic traditions that were always present in Chilean society. And of course, what happened was, to their great horror, that their loved ones or their friends disappeared. So, time and time again, we came across that.
Why would a parent turn in a child? Maybe you can explain from that example that you just told us about.
Well, in the case of the family we mentioned, and it's, I think you can generalize, it was a combination of, again, fear. Respect for the authorities, the presumption of, in Chile it had such a civilian, a civilized society for so many generations in which the military was subservient to civilian authority that people really couldn't believe that anything horrible would happen. In the case of the family that Arturo mentioned, this was a sort of middle-aged, middle-class couple whose daughter, like many other college students during the era of the Allende government, which preceded Pinochet, had gotten involved in leftist politics. It was very fashionable. It was the way things were going in the late 60s and early 70s in Chile and throughout the hemisphere. They didn't take it that seriously, and they didn't take what she was doing that seriously. And when the police came and said they wanted her for questioning, They were worried, they were concerned, but they had no idea that she would end up, in fact, tortured to death.
And they bear a great cross today. It was one of the most moving interviews, spending an afternoon, a Sunday afternoon, with this couple who's now raising their granddaughter, the daughter of this daughter of theirs that the mother herself turned in, and it was an extremely poignant experience.
Is this fairly typical that were there a lot of middle-class families where the parents were appalled at the leftist leanings of their children and couldn't understand it and ended up doing the wrong thing, like turning them in?
Yes, indeed. And also there were many examples of people whose relatives were turned in by others or who turned themselves in or who were caught. Pillars of the establishment who found out that with their niece or someone else in their family had been picked up, and then they tried to pursue various avenues in order to have them released or at least have them tried, and much to their horror found that was not possible.
It no longer counted. It no longer counted if you were an important person because everything had changed.
What do you think made it possible for the people of Chile to end the dictatorship of Pinochet?
Well, that's a short question with a very long answer. I would say it was a combination of many factors, one of which was international pressure. The United States in the mid-80s underwent a very strong change of policy towards Chile and made it very clear that it was no longer going to sit idly by and support what the regime had been doing. Also, people were very strongly motivated by the economic problems the country was having. One of the things that kept the regime going for such a long time was that it did stabilize the country economically and achieve a certain measure of economic success, and this put off what could have been a much earlier degree of protest against the government. After the economy collapsed for a second time in the early 1980s, people really were fed up, and the poor were getting poorer, and the middle class practically didn't exist anymore. And you had a sort of cumulative impact of political frustration, economic frustration, and the beginnings of international pressure against the regime, which combined to begin to sort of reawaken the old democratic roots and desires that people had suppressed in themselves for a decade.
I think you have to give a lot of credit to the opposition parties. At the end, there were 16 opposition parties, but they were able to bury their fundamental differences and come together in a common strategy, a common program, to try to defeat the dictator himself. And let's remember that in Chile, what's extraordinary is that the defeat of the dictator does not come through some kind of insurrectionary process or some kind of large mobilization of the masses, but through a defeat of the dictator in an election that the dictator himself had planned in order to legitimize further his own rule. So what these parties were able to do, and it took a lot of discipline and a lot of strength, was to bury their differences and then beat the dictator at his very own game.
Pinochet is that rare dictator who has managed to keep a government position after being deposed. He's the head of the army. And I don't know, I still kind of find that hard to fathom.
Well, in fact, it follows directly from what I just noted. The fact is that how did the opposition defeat the dictator? They realized that they did not have a chance to defeat the dictator or the president, the self-proclaimed president himself, with some kind of insurrectionary process. That they could only defeat him through the rules that the dictator himself had set up. And the irony is, of course, that by entering into the legality of the dictatorship, they, in a sense, accepted the legality of the dictatorship. And they accepted the rules and procedures that were set in place at the time. And among the constitutional rules that they had to accept was the fact that according to the Constitution of 1980 that Pinochet had implemented, the commanders-in-chief of the armed forces could stay in office without being removed all the way up until 1997. So the new government, the democratic government, bound by the rules, in a sense, that they inherited from the past,
can't then fire this gentleman.
I think it's important to add that even though he remains commander of the army, Pinochet, he really has behaved himself. He's made a couple of moves to try and undermine civilian authority, but he's been very firmly put in his place by the civilian president. And I think the reason he stays on is partly out of a pique and partly because he has vowed repeatedly to protect his men from any prosecution for human rights abuses. And so he's really staying on also out of loyalty to his troops who supported him during the regime. But as a political threat, I would not regard Pinochet at this point as any sort of danger to civilian authority or to democracy in Chile.
Do you think of the Chilean democracy as a stable democracy?
Well, right now it's still a democracy that is trying to feel its way. And I think that there's great hope for Chile because it did have a strong democracy in the past. And that's a very important element. But there's still a long way to go. For example, they really still have not had a completely free and open election because the electoral rules that they had in place for the last election were electoral rules that were deliberately designed by the military government in order to encourage support for its own supporters. It remains to be seen if in fully open and competitive elections, Chileans will be able to compete with one another with rules of civility. I do believe that that's going to happen. We do think that. But there's a long way to go before they can learn to compete again with one another fairly and openly.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Arturo Valenzuela and Pamela Constable are the authors of A Nation of Enemies, Chile Under Pinochet. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. This afternoon, we have a piece on former hostage Jesse Turner reunited with his family. Cy Hirsch, who is an investigative reporter, has written a book called The Samson Option. It sounds like a thriller, and apparently it is very interesting, but it's not fiction. We're going to take a look at sexual harassment and whether anything that happened over the weekend of the Thomas Hill confrontation has enhanced people's views of sexual harassment, and we're going to look at the abortion ruling from the state of Pennsylvania and its prospects in the Supreme Court.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Not many music lovers are familiar with the Czech composers Gideon Klein and Viktor Ullmann. Both of them died at an early age at the Theresienstadt concentration camp during the Nazi occupation of Czechoslovakia. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording of their music called Chamber Music from Theresienstadt.
Remember Arthur Miller's 1980 TV movie Playing for Time? Vanessa Redgrave played the part of Fania Fenelon, the Jewish violinist who survived World War II because she played in an orchestra of concentration camp inmates at Auschwitz. In 1941, the Nazis turned the Czechoslovakian town of Terezin into the Theresienstadt concentration camp. This was a way station to the gas chambers at Auschwitz. When the Nazi SS discovered that the Jewish prisoners had smuggled musical instruments into the town and were holding secret concerts, they used these performances for propaganda. They fixed up the buildings with false facades and forced the prisoners to perform in a film that showed how happy they were. But they also gave the musicians almost free rein about what to compose and perform. A new disc of chamber music from Theresienstadt includes music by two of the inmates, Viktor Ullmann, a 40-year-old conductor-composer, and Gideon Klein, a 20-year-old music student. Here's part of the last movement of Klein's piano sonata, played by Virginia Eskin. Thank you. Both Klein and Ullmann, with their use of Czech folk music, are obviously descended from Dvořák and Janáček. You can also hear the influence of Arnold Schoenberg's 12-tone system. Ullmann had actually studied composition with Schoenberg. The conductor William Steinberg led the world premieres of Ullmann's Concerto for Orchestra and First Piano Concerto in Prague. At Theresienstadt, Ullmann, who was also a music critic, wrote reviews of the concerts, an important source of information about what went on there. He and his wife were sent to Auschwitz and died in the gas chambers in 1944. Ullmann was 46. Gideon Klein was only just beginning. Except for some choral arrangements, this new recording includes everything he wrote at Theresienstadt, a string trio, a fantasy and fugue for string quartet, and a piano sonata. Here's the beginning of the second movement of Klein's string trio. It's a series of variations on a Moravian folk theme. It was written in 1944, 9 days before Klein was sent to Auschwitz. He died at the Fürstengrube concentration camp 3 months later, at the age of 26. This album is the first of at least 6 projected discs of music composed at Terezin. The performances by the Hawthorne String Quartet and pianist Virginia Eskin are eloquent and loving. The violist, Mark Ludwig, is also the director of the Terezin Chamber Music Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the musicians who were imprisoned there. This recording is a remarkable testament to the indomitability of the human spirit. I don't think you could tell just by listening to it where the music was written. All of it has such tremendous vitality. But this must also be one of the saddest recordings ever made.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Chamber Music from Theresienstadt, 1941 to 1945, on the Channel Classics label. This week, there's a reunion of survivors of Theresienstadt in Terezin, and much of the music composed there will be performed. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with one of America's foremost investigative journalists, Seymour Hersh. His new book asserts that Israel has a secret nuclear arsenal, which has influenced diplomatic relations with the United States. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.